And that is being young, Peter Walsh thought as he passed them, to have an awful scene in the middle of the morning. The poor girl looked very upset. But what was it about, he wondered? What had the young man been saying to make her look like that? What awful quarrel had they had to both look so unhappy on a fine summer morning? The fascinating thing about coming back to England after 5 years was the way it made one notice things as if one had never seen them before, like those lovers quarrelling under a tree. He had never seen London look so beautiful. The softness, the richness, the greenness, he thought, after India. And here, of course, one fell in love with every woman one met. There was a freshness about them, and all of them, even the poorest, were better dressed than 5 years ago, surely. And every woman now, even the finest, wore makeup and put it on in public. And young women would marry when it suited them. They would marry some rich man and live in a huge house near Manchester. Now, who was it who had done that? Peter asked himself, walking across the grass. Somebody who had written him a long letter quite recently, who had been thinking of him and the old days. It was Sally Seton, of course. Wild, romantic Sally. The last person in the world one would have expected to marry a rich man and live in a huge house near Manchester. But of all Clarissa's circle, Sally was probably the best. At least she was not fooled by men like Hugh Whitbread, who was the greatest snob and who had the most stupid admiration for the British upper class of any human being Peter had ever met. Hugh was like a top-class servant, somebody who walked behind his employer carrying luggage, who could be trusted to send telegrams or to write letters for hostesses. He had some silly little job now, looking after the king's wine or cleaning royal buttons. "And who are the Whitbreads?" he could hear Sally saying. "They sell coal." Hugh thought of nothing but his own appearance and stood for everything worst in British middle-class life, she said. Oh, but he was such a dear, so unselfish, giving up his own pleasure to help his old mother, Clarissa would say. And now, Peter thought, if he married Daisy and brought her to England, he would need Hugh Whitbread or Richard Dalloway to help him get a job with a good salary. He didn't mind asking Dalloway, who was a straightforward, sensible kind of man, not brilliant, and without a spark of imagination, but a good man. He ought to have been a country gentleman. He was wasted in politics. How good he had been when Clarissa's dog injured its leg so badly. Dalloway took care of it all, comforting Clarissa and all the time talking to the dog as if it were a human being. He remembered walking with Sally in the garden at Boughton, with its rose bushes and giant cauliflowers, and Sally begging him, half laughing of course, to carry off Clarissa. He must save her from the Hugh Whitbreads and the Richard Dalloways and all the other perfect gentlemen who would take away her spark and make a hostess of her. But one must be fair to Clarissa. She had a perfectly clear idea of what she wanted. Her emotions were all on the surface. Beneath, she was a far better judge of character than Sally, for example, and she had too that extraordinary woman's gift of making a world of her own wherever she was. In a room full of people, it was Clarissa one remembered. Not that she was beautiful or said anything especially clever, but there she was. No, no, no. He was not in love with her anymore. He only felt unable to get away from the thought of her after seeing her that morning which was not being in love, of course. It was simply thinking of her, criticising her, trying again to explain her after 30 years. The obvious thing to say about her was that she cared too much for her position in society. She had admitted it to him and told him that she hated people who didn't try. Failures like himself, he supposed. She thought that people must do something, be something. She once said that the older she became, the more she admired the courage of a woman like Lady Bexborough, who held herself upright. Clarissa did that herself, being as straight as an arrow, a little stiff, in fact. In all of this, she was guided by Dalloway, of course. She had to see things through her husband's eyes. These parties, for example, were all for him. She made her drawing room a sort of meeting place. She had a gift for it. Visiting, being kind to people, running about with bunches of flowers. But she did it sincerely. Since the whole of life is a bad joke, she used to say, let us at least do what we can to reduce the suffering of others and be as good as we possibly can. It was immediately after Sylvia's death, that terrible tragedy, that she developed these ideas. To see your own sister killed by a falling tree, which was all the fault of her father's carelessness, was enough to make one bitter, Clarissa always said. Instead, she developed this belief in doing good for the sake of goodness. And, of course, she enjoyed life enormously. If you walked with her in the park, she would notice the flowers, a baby in a pram, the young couples. She would probably have talked to those lovers if she had thought them unhappy. But she always needed people, and as a result, she wasted her time, always giving parties, talking nonsense. There was a reward to getting old, Peter Walsh thought, coming out of Regent's Park. While emotions remain as strong as ever, one has gained, at last, the ability to hold experience up to the light and turn it round slowly to examine it. Now, at the age of 53, he hardly needed people anymore. For hours at a time, he prayed that one could say these things without them being known. For hours and days, he never thought of Daisy. So, was he really in love? The truth was that she was in love with him. And when the ship actually sailed from India, he felt an extraordinary relief at being alone. If they were honest, Peter Walsh thought, everyone would say that one doesn't want people after 50. But what about these extraordinary states of emotion? Crying this morning? Clarissa probably thought him a fool, not for the first time. It was jealousy that was at the bottom of it. Jealousy which lasts longer than every other emotion, Peter Walsh thought, taking out his knife. In her last letter, Daisy mentioned another man. Even knowing that she said it on purpose to make him jealous made no difference to his wild jealousy. Coming to England and seeing lawyers wasn't because he wanted to marry her, but to prevent her marrying anybody else. That was what had come over him when he saw Clarissa so calm, so cold, sewing her dress. That was what she could have saved him from. She had turned him into a tearful old fool. But women don't know what love is, he thought, shutting his knife. Clarissa was as cold as ice. She would sit there on the sofa by his side, let him take her hand, give him one kiss. Oh, here he was at the street crossing. A sound interrupted him. A weak, thin, trembling sound, coming from just opposite Regent's Park tube station. An ageless, sexless voice with no beginning or end, and an absence of all human meaning, singing, Eum farum so, fu sui tu imu. The beaten, bent old woman, with one hand held out for coins, the other holding her side, stood singing of love. She sang of a love which has lasted 10 million years, of once walking in May with a man who had loved her.
Give me your hand, she said,
for Peter Walsh couldn't help giving the poor creature a coin as he stepped into his taxi.
And if someone sees, what do they matter?
Her trembling voice demanded.